Lecture 24, Medicine, the Necessary Art.
Welcome back. Remember last time I was telling you about my theory about the murder of Tutankhamun? Well, one thing that would play a little bit of a part in it would be the state of medicine in ancient Egypt. If he gets a blow to the back of the head, what might his treatment have been like? What I'd like to do in this lecture is turn to my specialty, which is I'm a specialist on mummies, but also medicine in the ancient world, paleopathology, diseases in the ancient world. I want to do a little one of our side trips. You know, we've been proceeding chronologically. We're getting towards the end of the 18th dynasty now. And I'd like to do one of our side trips and talk about medicine in the ancient world, what medicine was like to somebody like Tutankhamun. What did they have available? First of all, who were the physicians? Well, for the most part, they were priests. The priests were the learned men. The priests were the ones who could read and write. That was how you made your way up through the bureaucracy. You first became a scribe, then a priest. So, generally, the physicians come from the temples. We know this because of their titles. Very often we'll have a title, so-and-so was a physician of the temple of Sekhmet. So-and-so was a physician of the temple of Isis. So we know that physicians were associated with temples, and those temples were dedicated to very specific gods. There were really three gods who were sort of almost like the patron gods of the physicians. And let me tell you about them. If you know a little bit about the mythology, it makes sense why some of them were patrons of medicine. But one is a curious one. Most of the priests who were physicians, most of these physician priests, they're called Wabu. Wab is simply the word for a priest. It's an interesting word, by the way. It means to purify, Wab. And it's a hieroglyph that's kind of neat. It has a jar and water's pouring out of it, and a little foot under it. And that means to purify. Water coming out of a jar, you purify with water. Now, if you want to say priest, you put a little man behind it. Because a man who purifies is a priest. Right? So most of these physicians were Wabu, which is the plural of Wab. They were priests of Sekhmet. Now, it's curious that Sekhmet is a goddess associated with priests. She is a lioness. She is usually shown in statues as a woman with the head of a lioness, right? So she's fierce. And there's a myth that talks about her really being fierce. This is why I'm thinking that it's unusual that she's associated with healing and nice things. The myth is called The Destruction of Mankind. And according to this myth, the god Re, the sun god, was getting old, right? His bones were silver, is what it says. His bones were silver. And mankind wasn't listening to Re. And Re really got ticked off and did not like the idea that mankind wasn't listening to him. And at one point, he's thinking about wiping out all of mankind. Right? Not unlike a story in the Old Testament when the flood comes, right? Anyway, much of mankind is destroyed, but Re kind of relents. But what he's done is he's told Sekhmet, he said, "You're pretty fierce. You will be my eye. You go to earth and destroy mankind." But he relents. But the problem is they can't turn Sekhmet off. She's ready to destroy mankind. So Re has his assistants make up a mixture of ochre, you know, the red mineral ochre, which is used as a dye, and they mix it with beer. So it looks like blood. And they've got a lot of the earth covered with this beer an ochre, which looks like blood. And they send Sekhmet down and say, "That's the blood of mankind." And she was really happy about that. And she says, "I'm going to drink the blood of mankind." And she drinks it, becomes drunk, and forgets about destroying the rest of mankind. So mankind is saved because Sekhmet gets drunk. But that's why it's kind of curious that Sekhmet is one of the chief patron gods of physicians. Another god associated with the physicians is Thoth. And this one makes more sense. Now, Thoth is usually shown as an ibis. He is a man, has the body of a man, but the head of an ibis, the long-beaked bird. Thoth is an important god for a lot of reasons. He is the god of writing. It is Toth who invents writing. Now, writing is a strange thing, let me tell you, in the ancient world. Very strange. Obviously, it's a great invention. It's an important invention. But for some reason, the Egyptians didn't write down an awful lot of things, right? As you know, they didn't write down how to mummify. They didn't write down how to build pyramids and temples. A lot of things they didn't write down. They did write down their medicine, how to do medical practices. They did write that down. Now, Toth is the inventor of writing. And you know, the Greeks, who revered the Egyptians, they talk about the Egyptians and Toth as being the inventor of writing. But Plato says something very interesting about writing. He says, oh yes, the Egyptians invented a Toth, the god of writing. And it was a terrible invention. Terrible invention. Now think about it. You're going to get Plato. You're going to get good old Plato saying that it's a terrible invention. Why? He says, now men will have the appearance of knowledge, but not true knowledge. What he meant was, you didn't have to have it in your head anymore. You got it on a piece of papyrus, you can read it out loud, and it sounds like you know it, but you really don't know it. I mean, this goes back probably to the old tradition, the Greek tradition, where the Iliad and the Odyssey, they weren't written down. They were memorized and sung. You know, when you said, I know the Odyssey, didn't mean you read it and you remember a little bit. You could sing the whole thing. So there was that interesting tradition, even among the Greeks, that important things sometimes aren't written down. And Plato in a letter once said, the highest philosophy can't be written down. Now, and you know, Plato was the student of Socrates, who never wrote anything. Right? So there is this tradition that you don't write a lot of things down. But Toth, the god of writing, is the patron of all physicians. He is the god of medicine. And there is a myth which explains why he should be. There's actually a few of them. Almost all of it goes back to Isis and Osiris and their evil brother Seth. In one of the myths, if you remember, Osiris was killed by Seth. Right? He was evil. Right? Evil. And then Isis resurrects him. Right? So she has great power also. And we'll get to that. But Seth is still alive. And their son, Horus, who is the falcon, does battle with Seth. Doesn't kill him. Vanquishes him. Beats him. But in the battle, and this is the medical part, Horus's eye is taken out. He loses an eye. Now, the pieces of the eye are found. But there's one little piece missing. And according to the myth, the god Toth, the god of medicine, supplies the missing piece and restores the eye of Horus. And the eye of Horus became a magical amulet for health. So Toth, by magic, restores the eye of Horus, and this is a sign of health. So Toth is understandably a god of physicians. There's another myth in which he actually saves Horus's life. Now remember, Seth still exists. The evil is always in the world. And Isis is hiding her son Horus from Seth at one point, the infant Horus, when he's a baby. And she hides him in a thicket, but Horus is stung by a scorpion. And dies. And Isis starts wailing and crying. And she wails and cries so loudly that it goes up to the gods. And Horus comes down. I'm sorry, and Toth comes down, sees the dead Horus, and says, O poison of the scorpion, come out. And Horus resurrects. So Toth has resurrected the dead Horus. So he really is, understandably, a god of physicians. And this is why many physicians also came from temples of Toth. They were associated with Toth. Later, the Greeks are going to pick up on that myth, and Toth is going to become their Hermes. Right? And you get this tradition of hermetic writings, secret writings. Those are writings of Hermes that are lost. That's what it means. So this all comes from Egyptian mythology. It's interesting. Now, the third and most important, perhaps, of the goddesses and gods associated with medicine is Isis, of course. She has resurrected her own husband. That's pretty good. But there's a wonderful story that's, again, very close to the Bible, this time the New Testament, of the laying on of hands. Now, according to this story, Isis and her little infant Horus are fleeing from Seth. They're trying to hide. And Isis is sort of accompanied by a bodyguard of seven little scorpions. Now, seven is, of course, a magical number. There are seven sacred oils, you know. But she's got seven scorpions going with her. And she knocks on the door of a lady's house looking for shelter. And the lady sees the scorpions, I think, and she's, no, we don't have any room. And here is this mother and child, right? A goddess and a child is a god looking for shelter. And the lady says no. You know, sort of like no room at the inn. And then the scorpions become angry. And they put all of their venom on the tail of one of them. So one of the seven has all of the venom of the seven scorpions. And this woman has a child. And it stings the child, and the child dies. Now, the woman is, of course, distraught that her child has been killed by this little scorpion. And Isis takes pity on this woman and puts her hands on the child. It's the laying on of hands, and heals him, and the child resurrects. So Isis, too, has this power of healing, healing hands, and resurrection. Right? So we get these gods are associated through mythology with healing and resurrection, and that's why physicians came from temples associated with these gods. Right? Now, where did you go for healing? You know, they didn't make house calls. This wasn't like traveling physicians. They were priests. You went to the temple for your healing. You actually went to the temple. It was like the clinic. It was. And one temple that was really associated with healing was Dendera. It's a temple in the south of Egypt. It was dedicated to Hathor, who was also associated with Isis. And if you were sick, you could go to Dendera, and you could have dreams there that would tell you what to do so you would be cured. So, for example, there were little rooms in Dendera where you could sleep overnight in the temple, in these sacred grounds. Remember how sacred temples are in Egypt. You know, we're so used to being taught that you go to church, you go to synagogue on a certain day. That wasn't the Egyptian practice. Temples weren't for the people. No way. They were for the priests. These were secret, special places. So if you went to a temple to sleep overnight, it was a big deal. It wasn't like sleeping in the back of the church. So you could expect some great dreams. So people often went to these temples to have dreams to hear how to be healed. There was also the water cure. And this is, you know, I'm sure of it. It's the origins of holy water. There were statues in the temples called sippi. They're usually statues like a stela, small stela, the round top thing, carved with Horus, the infant Horus, who becomes very powerful, of course. And he's standing on a crocodile, and he's holding scorpions. The idea is he's got everything under control. And what they did, the priest would pour water over the top of this little statue. And it was collected at the bottom. And then you could drink it. It was holy water. Once you drink that water, you could be cured. So the water became magical by being associated with the statue. It was important. So you could go to temples for cures. And, you know, remember Queen Hatshepsut's temple, Deir el-Bahari? That beautiful temple where she put the scenes on the walls of the obelisk being moved and the expedition to Punt? Well, centuries after Hatshepsut died, centuries after she was dead, in the late period of Egyptian history, that temple was being used as a clinic. On top of the roof of that temple, there were physicians, priests, and you could come there and get healed. And on top of that temple are inscriptions on the walls of even Greeks who came and said, I came here, I asked the god for help, and I was cured. Farewell. Right? These temples were associated with famous earlier physicians. For example, Imhotep, remember the architect of the step pyramid of Zoser way back in the 3rd dynasty when we talked about the Old Kingdom? Imhotep was the royal architect, but he was also the royal physician. And he later became a god, Asclepius, the Greek god of healing. So associated with this temple was the god Imhotep. Right? There was also Amenhotep, son of Hapu, right, who was the great another architect physician. People came to ask for their blessings. So you went to temples for healing. It was an important thing to do if you were sick. It was your only hope. Now, were there anybody else who were physicians besides the priests? One theory was, and I'll tell you why I don't think it's the right theory. One theory is that a lot of Egyptian medical science came out of mummification. Now, it's not a bad theory. It's not a foolish theory by any means. Egypt was famous for its physicians. Famous. If a king of a foreign country was on good terms with the Egyptian king, he would say, send me a physician. They were renowned Egyptian physicians throughout the ancient world for their skills. In Egypt, medicine was called the necessary art. Necessary art. And many people feel that one of the reasons that Egyptians were so good at medicine is that they practiced mummification, and that's how you learn anatomy. You know? You're taking out internal organs as part of the mummification process? These guys were learning anatomy. As a matter of fact, if you read ancient Greek medical texts, they often say, I wish I had studied in Egypt, because there they could practice dissection. See, Greece forbade the cutting up of a human body. You couldn't cut up. Body was sacred. So they practiced on primates. You know, if you went to medical school, you might have an ape or something like that, but you didn't have a human. You didn't. So many Greeks even said, oh, I wish I had studied in Egypt. So many people feel, and it's a reasonable theory, that the Egyptians were so good because the embalmers had all that anatomical knowledge. I don't think it's a correct theory, though, for two reasons. One is, first of all, the embalmers were on a different level from the physicians. They were considered a little bit like outcasts, just a little. They were dealing with dirty things. They were smelly because they worked with chemicals. So they were a little bit outcast. But also, you know, when you think about how mummification took place, and I'll be giving a whole separate lecture just on mummification, you'll see. But the internal organs were taken out through an incision only about 2.5 inches in the abdomen. You don't see much anatomy that way. You're kind of pulling things out in the dark almost. You don't see the relative position of the gallbladder, the liver, the kidneys. No. So I don't think they really learned that much good anatomy. So I don't think the embalmers helped that much. But it's something. Maybe they contributed a little bit. They weren't the physicians. Now, as I said, fortunately for us, one of the things the Egyptians did write down was medical papyri. They wrote down instructions to physicians. Quite a few. And there are two different kinds. They sort of come in two different flavors. One flavor is clinical, what I call clinical. What I mean by that is it's a kind of treatment which we might expect in a hospital today based on science, observation. That's one kind of medical papyrus. The other is magical. But let's talk about medical first. The best one we have, the best one by far, is the Edwin Smith surgical papyrus. It deals with trauma. Real trauma. I mean, trauma by the sense of broken bones, right? Now, it's clinical. What it does, it treats 48 cases of physical trauma from top to bottom. Starts with the head, describes the case, tells you what to do, goes to the next case, down and down and down. And the suggestions are quite sensible. Now, each case is treated in the following way. The symptoms are described. And as I say, they're almost always broken bones, the results of a trauma. The papyrus dates from around 1700 BC. 1700 BC. But many people think it's much earlier, of the Pyramid Age, because of the kinds of illnesses. Or injuries, I should say, even. They're not even illnesses. They're broken bones. The kinds of things that you get when you're handling large pieces of stone, they're construction industry, you know, construction industry injuries. You're building a pyramid. The block falls. Your arm is broken. Your head is smashed in. So many people think they come from the Pyramid Age. It looks like it's copied papyrus from an earlier date, from the language, from the way it's presented. So some people even suggest that it comes from the first pyramid in stone, the Step Pyramid, and maybe the architect, who was a physician, Imhotep, is actually the author of the Edwin Smith surgical papyrus. It could be. What is really interesting is what it tells the physician to do. Okay, you've got an injury. It describes the injury. Let's say it's an injury to the frontal bone That's your forehead, basically. It's crashed in. It's crushed. You can see part of the brain. Right? We'll describe that. The next thing is it tells the physician what to say. And you have three possibilities to tell the patient or the family if the poor guy's unconscious. You can say, this is an illness which I will treat. Now, that's optimistic. It means I'll treat it. It's going to get better. You can then say, plan B, this is an illness with which I will contend. Now, that means I'll do what I can do, but I'm not sure the patient's going to survive. And the third possibility you can say is, this is an illness which I will not treat. Now, for each ailment, the papyrus tells the physician which one of those three to say. So there are illnesses, injuries, which you're supposed to walk away from. You can say, I can't treat this. Now, why? No physician ever says, I can't treat it. You do something, especially a trauma injury. I think the answer is, it's a medical papyrus that's also concerned about the reputation of the physician. And if you treat a lot of patients who die, you don't look so good. You don't gain anything by treating a patient who's going to die. So that's why you have a whole class of things you say, this is something which I cannot treat. And this papyrus, written by a skilled physician, is the equivalent of an emergency room doctor who's used to treating trauma, is telling you what to say. Right? Interesting. Now, once you're told what to say, it then goes on to the treatment, if indeed one of those two things, I will treat it or I will contend with it. And one of the most interesting things about this papyrus is it tells you about the brain, because head injuries reveal the brain. Now, let me emphasize this. Too much has been made about what the Edwin Smith Surgical Papyrus says about the brain. It describes it. It talks about the convolutions of the brain. It talks about, it says it looks like molten copper when it's poured. You get like rivulets, you know, talking about the convolutions of the brain. But it does not really tell you that they knew the function of the brain. Many people think it suggests that. Because what it says is when you get an injury to the head, sometimes the arm is immobilized. Or you get an injury to the head, sometimes the leg is immobilized, which of course happens when you get brain trauma due to brain damage. You can't move a limb. But that doesn't mean they understood the function of the brain, because at mummification, that's the one organ they threw away. They didn't keep the brain. They believed you thought with your heart. And as a matter of fact, there's even a mistake in the papyrus about what happens when you get a trauma injury to the brain. It says, if you're injured on the right side of the brain, sometimes the right arm is immobilized. It happens the other way usually. The right side of the brain controls the left side of the body. So normally when you get a trauma to the right side, it's the left side that has the involvement. Only rarely does it happen an injury to the head on the right causes an arm, say, to be immobilized on the right. That's only if, for example, you get the trauma, the brain is kind of flying across your cranium, has enough room there, and smashes against the other side of your cranium. Then you get the brain injury on the left side of the head. But that doesn't happen very often. So they do describe the brain. It even says, remove splinters when you see them in the brain, right? Which is a good procedure. But it doesn't mean that they understood the function of the brain. But we are told things that are very clinical, very reasonable, right? I mean, they tell how to splint arms, bandage it, put a poultice on it. Reasonable things, clinical. The one curious thing is, with all these clinical cases, there's 48 cases. There are 47 that are clinical. There's one that's magical. It says, and I think this suggests, that this is a papyrus that's been copied from earlier sources, and they're including everything. If they found an extra spell, we'll throw it in. It's a frontal injury to the forehead. And it says, if you have a fractured frontal bone, what do? You take an eggshell and you grind it up with some fat and other ingredients, and you put it on the forehead. Right? You put it on the forehead. I think what they're planning is a kind of magical cure, sympathetic magic. The idea is that an ostrich cell is round, kind of like a skull, like what you want to be it like. You want your skull to be round and nice and whole and complete. So you take an ostrich shell, which is round, grind it up, put it on your head, and your head will become like the ostrich shell. It's a magical cure. But this is only one side of the Edwin Smith Surgical Papyrus. There's another flip side, which is kind of really interesting. This is where it gets magical, right? So probably another source. And this is what I think is a wonderful example of magic. And it's so close to what we do almost. Remember, they didn't have germ theory. They didn't know about germs, bacteria. They had no idea what caused the fever. No idea. When you broke your arm, you could see the cause. The block fell on it. So you have a clinical treatment. But when you don't know the cause, then they resorted to magic. Then they resorted to spells if you had a fever, something like that. Now, the Egyptians apparently suffered a plague every year. It was called the pest of the year, right? Meaning not in the sense of a nuisance kid, but rather a plague that came every year. And they said it came on the winds. Quite interesting. Came on the winds. Now, they give you various treatments for it, right? But one of the treatments that I think is interesting, and they're usually exorcism, get rid of the demons. But one of the treatments is to burn the bed linens. Isn't that interesting? It's almost like they knew it was contaminated, it was contagious, something like that. But this is the other side of the Edwin Smith surgical papyrus. So I think what it shows is that physicians were trying both approaches. They would do clinical things when the cause of the injury or illness was known. When the cause was unknown, like an infection, it was usually treated magically, as if demons were inside the person, or something like that, as close as they could get to perhaps our germ theory. Now, along with these spells on the Edwin Smith surgical papyrus, is a spell to make an old man a youth. That's what it's called, a spell for making an old man a youth. And you know what it is? It's wrinkle cream. It's a cream that you're supposed to make. It gives you some, you know, a few plants to mix in with fats and herbs and that kind of thing. And then you put it on your face. It's a wrinkle cream. But that is a spell to make an old man into a youth, and it says works a million times. Right? I'm surprised somebody hasn't marketed it yet. You know, you pick up the ancient Egyptian spell. You know? But there were lots of these things that they tried. Let me say this about the ingredients in these spells. This is the origin of pharmacology. This is where we're getting the sense that certain ingredients, if mixed in the right proportions, in the right way, will cause health. Right? Now, I don't mean to suggest that it was all nonsense. Some of it probably had what we would call today active ingredients. I'll give you an example. If you had a kid, a child who was colicky, crying a lot, there was a spell where you mixed in various ingredients and gave the kid a potion to drink. Now, one of those ingredients was poppies. You might be giving this kid a little bit of opium, and that would be an active ingredient, would quiet the child, and would work. That's what we would call an active ingredient. Right? So some of it may have been a kind of trial and error that actually worked. But this is not only the beginning, say, of surgery. And in a sense, they didn't do surgery, they did repair work. They would splint, they would wrap, they would bandage. But they didn't tend to cut open and work on you while you were awake. They didn't have anesthesia. What were they going to do? And they didn't have really sharp knives. You know, it's not easy to do surgery. So they did what they could, but they had this clinical approach, and they had something that was a little more magical. Now, the Edwin's surgical papyrus, it's only one. There are plenty of medical papyri. Ever Smith, papyri are usually named after people who own them, and Ebers was the one who found it. Papyrus Ebers describes 800 medical treatments. 800. And it's everything. It's got stuff for headaches. If you have a headache, you take fish and you can make an ointment, and you don't take it internally, you spread it on your head. Because naturally, it sounds like there's something wrong with your head, not internally. They would never think of that. And then there was spells for blindness. Blindness was always treated as having been caused by the gods. It was called when the gods made me see night during the day. So there were magical spells for blindness also. If you had a lame foot, the London Leiden magical papyrus tells you to wrap it with a deer skin. The idea is a deer is fleet of foot, runs quick, and maybe by sympathetic magic, the fleetness of the deer skin will come into your foot. So there was two approaches to illnesses in ancient Egypt. One, clinical, but the other was magical, when the cause wasn't known. Now, next time, what I want to do is get us back on our chronological track and we'll go back to Tutankhamun and talk about what happens after his death. I'll see you then.
I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. We hope you've enjoyed the lectures on these tapes. To order more courses or to receive a copy of our most recent catalog, call 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-TEACH-12. Or visit our website at www.teachco.com. Thank you very much for listening.